Hello, everybody, and welcome to our 60th Rays and Initiations webinar commentary in part two of the book. We were dealing with some interesting things, just a slight review. It was about the blending of the master's mind with the mind of the disciple. And I emphasize this particular sentence, relationship to the ashram and contact with the master are dependent upon the existence of the Antahkarana. So this is a tremendous incentive for us to build the Antahkarana as it leads into the ashram. In the early stages of its creative construction, the Antahkarana is adequate to permit some contact with the ashram and with certain of the disciples, though not with those of very high degree. We have to remember this because, in a way, you know, we are beginners in building this rainbow bridge. Later, as the Antahkarana perfects itself, interesting because it's not only we who are doing the perfecting, but there's work coming from the other side of the Antahkarana, the higher side, so to speak, higher and more durable contacts become possible. The result of these developed and registered contacts are finally seen, this is the finality here, in the complete impressibility at any time and without any effort on either side of the disciple's mind. That's what we have been aspiring towards, and we began with that which was an occasional awareness, a fleeting awareness, and then there was gradual improvement. You see, he's done these, I think, in four sections. So the disciple later recognizing a direct call from the ashram, and then a further step that the master can stimulate the disciple's mind with no fear or risk of bad qualities of self-satisfaction and separateness emerging here. Okay, this is not correct. Let's just say this is separateness. I'm just going to call this separateness, evaporates. And there can be a flow of thought between the two, so that is the third stage. Mostly it starts out with the master, but eventually there can be a dialogue established, and the disciple can respond. The disciple initiate can respond. He can be permitted to reach the master with his own reaction to impression. Okay, that's the third stage. Just to review, I find the review of these matters so very important. It's easy for even the clearest list to, so to speak, disappear in the great amount of text which DK has provided. And finally, the fourth stage, wherein the disciple can be trusted to be the initiatory agent of impression and contact and is allowed to evoke, not only invoke, but evoke the master's attention and to penetrate to the center of the ashram, because the master will respond. So, and we compared, as we remember, these four stages of blending the master's mind with that of the disciple with the last four stages of six of the six stages of discipleship. Master DK is often asking us to correlate the different lists that he gives us. These are telepathic interplays, and the master uses the abstract mind to contact the lower mind of the disciple. So the master will therefore be dependent upon the use of the Antahkarana, which the disciple is in process of building, because we know that, let's see, I wonder if I can find that chart 8. Yeah. We know that there is that gap in communication between the mental unit and the monastic permanent atom. So unless the master is to somehow reach the disciple through the egoic lotus and causal body, through what we call the soul, usually any direct kind of meeting will be required, requiring Ananta Karana. Okay, just one moment here as I get my apparatus sort of figured out. Excuse me. Okay, so where are we? So the Antikarana is, the building of it is deemed at this point timely and wise and necessary at this point. I think I can use this image again. If it helps, maybe it helps. At least it lets you know that I'm there with you. And it depends on the light, I suppose. Okay, we'll let it go at that. So so we can see the importance of the Antikarana in terms of ashramic contact, and why we are enlisted to carefully build this Antikarana, and also, of course, the group Antikarana, which permits of even higher impressions. So, again, relationship to the ashram and contact with the master are dependent upon the existence of the Antikarana. And that takes us into the idea that there will be complete impressibility, finally, in this fourth stage, at any time and without effort on any side of the disciple's mind, because we have proven that indeed we are working within the ashram in a constructive way according to the divine plan, and we can be trusted not to become overstimulated, have our lower ego overstimulated. And the minute that happens, that lower ego begins to swell and take up too much space in our field of consciousness, crowding other important things out and destroying our sense of proportion. Humility depends on an adjusted sense of proportion, and without humility, we are pretty well useless as hierarchically affiliated workers. Reciprocal activity has become possible. Okay, so now we're into, after that little review, which occasionally, you know, one does carry out, one is into number 60. And I just realized I didn't press my chronometer, so I'm not sure whether this is going to come out around an hour in duration, or maybe a little bit more. We'll see how it goes. I think I've been speaking for, let's say, 7 or 8 minutes, and hopefully I can keep it close to an hour. There's so many little things to manage as you're doing these programs. I would be better off as a Shiva with maybe 10 arms than I could accomplish all this. It is needless, says the Tibetan, it is needless, surely, for me to point out that the theme of all impressions coming from the master to the disciple and from the disciple to the master is service to the plan. Obviously, he's trying to decentralize us here. The problems connected with group work in the Aquarian Age or with the life and relationship to the ashram. I think, you know, he's pretty well telling us that personal issues, unless they really touch upon these factors, service, group work in the Aquarian Age, life and relationship within the ashram, unless these personal problems really are somehow inhibiting effectiveness, in these areas, then they will not be the subject of the exchange. Although it is really interesting, isn't it, you know, how often Master D.K. did talk about the ways in which his students, whose letters are gathered in the Dyna books, needed certain personal adjustments. But then I'm quite sure that it is these personal adjustments which did touch upon their effectiveness in the group work that he was intending to see accomplished. Forget not that the ashram has its own objectives, intentions, and inner techniques, which are unconnected with the disciple's life and his service in the three worlds. Well, this is all part of, all part of getting off the center of our own stage. In our field of consciousness, and I think there's a good one for us, we'll call it field of consciousness. If in our field of consciousness we are always occupying the center, we do not see truly and with proportion. I don't know what it takes to recognize that we're out of proportion, or we're exaggerating or minimizing or somehow dwelling on less important things and blowing them up in relative value. But the day comes. Excuse me. The work of the disciple in preparation for initiation is not basically concerned with his daily world service, though there would be no initiation for him if that life of service were lacking. Now, okay, let's look at that. The work of the disciple in preparation for initiation is not basically concerned with his daily world service. You know, one simply assumes that service will be present and growing in effectiveness, though there would be no initiation for him if that life of service were lacking. And this is something that we all need to bear closely in mind. We're not going to find true initiation if we are not serving, simply wanting to be initiated, wanting to get through that door, which turns out to be a figment of our imagination if we imagine that we go through the door alone. That's not enough. His life of service is, in reality, an expression of the particular initiation for which he is being prepared. Very interesting. So according to the standards and revelations of the coming initiation, so will be our life of service. According to the revelations of the coming initiation, so will be the nature of our life of service. The theme is too vast for us to consider here, but it is an idea upon which you could well ponder. So what would we do? Perhaps a hint can be gathered. Look at the type of service you are rendering. Does it give a hint concerning the initiation towards which you are striving? Now that, with a little pondering, it might tell us something, because our service does carry the hallmark of certain qualities and accomplishments and certain objectives that we have in view. Now we're sort of, through service, in a way, we are somewhat practicing for initiation, while being, of course, very useful. Through service, we are somewhat practicing for initiation, at the same time being useful to our fellow human beings and to our planet. you do see how those abbreviations do help in the long run. So taking a little time to make sure that they're there is useful for all of us. And maybe if you're writing about these things or preparing lectures or whatever, the abbreviation method will be useful to you. One hint I will give you, based on the life of the Christ, in his previous incarnation, of course, the life history and the experiences of the great initiates are rarely given, but much has been communicated to us anent the life of the Christ. I guess, you know, it's more of the fruits rarely given. It is more the fruits which are important for us to understand. Excuse me. But much has been communicated to us anent the life of the Christ, both in the Gospels and in connection with his earlier incarnations. Uh-huh. All right. So maybe Maitre E, I'm not sure that's spelled, but in the Upanishads, he seems to show up as this particular figure who knows very much about oneness, unity, and the general theme of the Upanishads, also as Krishna. I think D.K. mentions Krishna and one other, but he does not give a name. As you know, he took one of the greatest of the initiations, the sixth initiation, that of decision, you know, that was inaugurated in the garden of Gethsemane. This initiation is related to the throat center and the third ray, and also to its higher correspondence, the throat center of the planetary logos, which is, yes, humanity. This is the center which we call humanity. Thus, the word came forth. The word came forth. Well, was he then, in a way, a word of Sanat Kumara, a word of our planetary logos, the word perhaps revealing the will of God came forth. He had a dual mission to fulfill in order to prove his fitness, if one can use such a word in connection with an initiate of his exalted standing. He had, first of all, to give a great impetus to human evolution by proclaiming two things, that the blood is the life, and this reminds us of the relationship between Mars, the blood, and Neptune, the life. Well, maybe I should put that in capitals and make sure that we've got our Neptune here. Okay, N-E-P-T-U-N-E, right. The blood is the life, to change the relationship of human beings to each other, not just based on elemental family blood relationships, but on their unity and their oneness with the one great life, and thus their brotherhood. So relationships are not just based on elemental similarity and family closeness, but on the life in which all human beings are brothers and sisters. Okay, and relationships, RELS, we do want the plural there. Okay. So that's one thing that he did. He first, and this is the impetus to human evolution. Now, how would the blood is the life, give that impetus. It would give a new type of relationship between human beings and the old tribe and clan and the small groups which to whom loyalty is declared rather than to the larger type of integration. These things would be overcome and a larger type of relationship allowed. That's one way at least. Now, what else did he do? That all men everywhere are sons of God and therefore divine. Well, let's just say the second here is related to the first. So it's not just relationships of blood and family, or even of region or nation, but all are sons of God. And just trying to save myself time in the future, all are sons of God. And all are related to the Father or life principle, and therefore all are divine. Now, I wonder if we realize that we do have our preferences. We do see people doing things that we think are quite against the plan. We find people doing certain things which are horrible in our own eyes. And do we remember somehow in the midst of all this that these people are misguided and ignorant temporarily, and that all of them, as a matter of fact, everything we see really is divine. It's all of one divine substance, which under some circumstances we call life. Okay, so this is all about his dual mission, the Christ dual mission, to fulfill his, demonstrate his fitness for his next move ahead as the world teacher for 5,000 years. When he was experiencing the sixth initiation, he had already been the world teacher for 500 years, one-tenth of the duration of that to which he acquiesced. So the great impetus to human evolution, and I suppose people who are really understanding history very well from the esoteric point of view see what that impetus may be when comparing it to the eons and eons which have unfolded before that time. Okay, so that's the first here. So, firstly, he did these two things. This is what he reminded us of. And secondly, he had to bring to an end the Jewish dispensation, which should have climaxed and passed away with the movement of the sun out of Aries into Pisces. Well, you know, this is like a transition. Let's see if I get this. This is like a transition from the first solar system to the second solar, second solar system. Let's see what will happen if I do that. No, I see. So I'm going to try this then. Second solar system, the solar systems. All right. Apparently, I have that one going already. But anyway, let me just get this one straightened out. First solar system, first major solar system, that is, because there were three that preceded that, which were of a minor nature to the, and I'll just do it this way, to the second solar system. This one's taking a little longer than I intended. Okay, SDSS, and we'll call that the second solar system. Now, really, it's the fifth that we are presently engaged with. excuse me. He therefore presented himself to them as their Messiah, their Savior, their Liberator. Of course, his presentation was misunderstood. It was understood in Aries terms, I suppose. They expected him to be a great warrior who would overcome the Roman occupation or the Roman oppression, which was the reason for manifesting through the Jewish race. DK tells us that that will not happen again. But of course, if you think about it, he used the Jewish body of the initiate Jesus in an overshadowing sense. Now, if perchance he uses his own Maya Virupa in his next appearance, it would naturally not be of the Jewish quality. Somewhere, I think maybe Leadbeater says that it has, it's an Irish vehicle. Now, you know, you can take all these things with a grain of salt. Oftentimes, masters will use as a Maya Virupa the vehicle through which they took their fifth initiation. But in this case, one is not imagining that Christ took a fifth initiation in that kind of vehicle. It would have to have been before, because he's been the head of the hierarchy ever since around 500 BC. So what was the nature of the vehicle on which the Maya Virupa was modeled, if that usual way of doing things applied to him? Well, so he wanted to bring certain first solar system ideas, to bring certain first solar system tendencies to a halt, and help humanity get with the program of the second solar system. But this didn't work out so very well. They said, DK says here, they not only rejected him, but have succeeded in perpetuating the Jewish dispensation through the medium of its religious presentation throughout the era of the Christian dispensation. And, you know, you do find many Christians who are rooted in the Old Testament, and it is to them as important as the New Testament. And so you kind of wonder, you know, who many of these people really are. You know, when you're looking to find a member of the Jewish group, you don't necessarily have to look for a racial type, because they can be incarnated in different racial types. So that makes it quite interesting to determine who really are the nomads who wandered from the previous major solar system, which we often call the first solar system, into this solar system, you know, via the bridge which Saturn had created. Will they all be found in the Jewish group? And as far as that goes, will all who are found in the, in what we call the Jewish group racially, will they necessarily be true members of the Jewish group? Maybe they're just there for a particular experience, temporary. And that was the case, I think, with a couple of the senior disciples found in Master DK's group, such as RSU, Regina Keller, and FCD, Roberto Assagioli. Their relationship to the Jewish group was not a permanent thing. It was a temporary expedient. Okay, so this, they not only rejected him, but they perpetuated the Jewish dispensation, which is what the Christ hoped to overcome and transcend. But we have it, you know, and with Christianity today, as it is so often taught in some of the more fundamental presentations, we do have very much the presence of the whole Jewish approach. And in Masonry, until the Reformation had begun, we had present also the Jewish approach. So this was something that was not intended, and it was perpetuated. I guess it's a very strong tendency because it has lasted so many millions of years. And that's the issue. Excuse me. Okay. Just tapping my table here. All right. Where are we? Okay, so this lies at the root of their trouble and is the cause of their constant emphasis upon the past, this backward looking to the, well, maybe the appreciated successes which occurred during the first major solar system. But this is what he's talking about here, however, is a much more recent backward looking, a backward lookingness into the experiences in Aries and not upon their growth in Pisces. Though we find now that many are excuse me, taking up the Piscean tendencies. Okay, it's what would we say, 2,000 years too late, but or at least 2,000 years late, but perhaps never too late. Okay. So, going on. This entire subject of telepathic interplay between the disciple and the ashram, between the master and the disciple, is one of unique interest. He really deals with this so much in the 14 rules for disciples and initiates, and it's something that we really do want to know about so that we do not exaggerate its importance in our lives and we do not minimize it. You know, if we are spiritually selfish in a strange sort of way and simply want contact with the ashram for its own sake rather than for the service that it can provide, then we are on the wrong track. So anyway, we're dealing with telepathic interplay between the disciple and the ashram, between the master and the disciple. Let's see what DK says about its unique interest. It certainly is a way that we can grow into presentation of the divine plan. It is part of the dual life which all disciples must lead. Okay, they lead their life within the lower three worlds, and they also are contacting the soul, the ashram, and the master. So let's put that down. See, life in the lower three worlds of service, and life in contact with the soul, soul, the ashram, and the master. It is that which intensifies the life of introspection. Sometimes DK talks about introspection as if it's not such a good thing because it seems to cut off certain disciples or from the right kind of contact with others, but the right kind of introspection puts the disciple in touch with high subjective factors, soul, ashram, and master. It is that which intensifies the life of introspection, which is only rightly understood and carried forward when the man is in truth a soul-infused personality. Now, there is... That's really interesting. So only soul-infused personality can introspect correctly and usefully. Okay. I sometimes have a word that I refer to as a coined word, infuseception, which means the ability to perceive the unifying factor which unites all apparent differences. Anyway, this is introspection. It is the source and origin of the extroverted life which the disciple must also lead. But he has to go forth with some energy discovered within. It's not just a question of being outgoing. It's a question of reaching others which has been discovered through introspection. Okay. So it is the source and origin of the extroverted life which the disciple must also lead, producing an intense activity in the three worlds, an activity which in no way disturbs the calm procedures of the life of ashramic contact. So again, there is a kind of a pair of opposites, a kind of pair of opposites must be mastered here. So activity without and calmness within. Rightly followed, it produces the possibility with which our third point deals. Okay, so this is the Christ came here to do two things. The first, impel human evolution and teach a whole new way of relating to blood and life and a whole new type of relationship. And secondly, to end the Jewish dispensation, which not only, in my view anyway, had been carrying over from the age of Aries, but had been carrying over from the first solar system. So that really, you know, there's so much of value in the Old Testament, which DK has told us is essentially the garnered wisdom of the first solar system, but it cannot perpetuate itself forever, you know. And he calls it, we know that the Kabbalah is kind of a synthesis of much of that wisdom, but he calls it a secondary line of spiritual pursuit, because in a way we are passing it by and we have to become used to the methods of the present solar system, which is a second ray major solar system and not a third ray major solar system as was the previous one. Okay. So now we deal, is this our third point? Impression on the mind of the disciple of hierarchical intent. Okay, so this is not just, a fusing with the master's mind, but something of what the hierarchy is intending is solidly impressed upon the disciple's mind so that he can represent the divine plan more successfully. All right, so let's see what is said here. This is something far greater and more inclusive than the ability of the mind of the disciple to register the content of the minds within the ashram with which he has affiliated, or even the mind of the master. So we have passed on from this registration of the mind of the master upon the mind of the disciple, which is powerful enough, difficult enough to achieve, requires a long period of adjustment and purification on the part of the disciple, so that the master can, without undue risk, merge the content of his mind, or some of the content, with the content of the disciple's mind. This is something more. The purpose aspect of the plan begins to impress his now highly illumined abstract mind, for the integrated purpose, as far as hierarchy is concerned, begins slowly to impress him. Well, purpose, the purpose factor is found on the monadic level and beyond. Let's make sure that I can get back there. The purpose factor is found on the monadic plane. Found on the monadic plane and beyond. And it is that, it is this factor which guides the divine plan. So still a still higher spiritual source is now impressing. Okay, this must be the morning not to spell. All right. So this is the third step, not just the fusion of with the mind of the master and of the ashram, but something greater. Little by little, he begins to register impressions from Shambhala. So basically, in this third, what does he call it here? Third what? third point. Okay. In this third point, we are moving beyond hierarchical impression. So in this third point, we move beyond hierarchical impression. Little by little, he begins to register impressions from Shambhala. With this, I cannot deal. It concerns the growth which follows the fourth and fifth initiations. Now, remember how the monad becomes very impressive at the fourth initiation, and therefore the training given to the master. We are all in the process of training. Even planetary logoi are, and solar logoi. And there's one that I think I have to have. SLS, solar logoi, and not just logos. We're all in process of training. Now, I wonder if the great and universal being we call the universal logos is in process of training. I think he's in process of expression, because what is he anyway but a precipitation of the ray of the absolute? He is a finite being selected by the absolute deity, which is an infinite deity. Okay, but anyway, we're not so concerned with the training given to the master. It's way beyond us. But it is nice to know that there is no arresting of growth. The great mistake with some world religions or adherents of some of those religions feel that the last word has been spoken with the revelation of their religion to humanity, and that somehow throughout all eternity, which is probably inconceivable to such people, There can be no further revelation, only this final revelation, which of course is pitifully finite in scope. But as the mind begins to expand, we begin to learn that we conceive of the universe and of God according to the capacities of our own minds. So basically, we're making God in our image, even though it is also true from another perspective that God makes man in his image. And maybe the form which Sanat Kumara can take and can use shows us something about the ideal human being archetypally considered. We don't need, I think, anything beyond in this fourth round, the fourth level of form, but later there will be more. Your major task as aspirants, DK says, is to cultivate a higher sensitivity. Well, we are aspirants for initiation, and I'm sure this is also true of disciples. Disciples are aspirants too. To render yourself so pure and selfless that your minds remain undisturbed by the happenings in the three worlds. This is demanding. This is our major task. So pure and selfless. I'm recalling, and you know, sometimes you forget where you get things, but there was a statement by Blavatsky. Was it written? Was it verbal? That she knew a youth in Tibet who was so pure that no lie would ever pass his lips. So that was the Tibetan. And when we have this dedication to truthfulness, we shall see the truth. Well, anyway, pure and selfless, we reach that in whatever manner we can. You know how it is during these troubled times. I read somewhere that people are suffering from headline distress or headline anxiety. What is it that keeps you from reading the headlines before you go to sleep, and maybe in the middle of the night, and maybe when you wake up in the morning? Of course, it will cause distress and disturbance, and the Christ is said to demonstrate something exactly opposite to that, a calmness forever unperturbed, a calmness which cannot be disturbed. So we have to view the happenings in the three worlds in a different way. If we do not achieve this, then we suffer from what Master Moria calls imperil, or what the Tibetan calls irritation. Not the usual types of irritations, but a state of always being disturbed by that which transpires around one, even though it is evanescent and an inevitable part of the world of becoming. So we look on life, if we can achieve it. I certainly have achieved it with serenity, deep, deep serenity, knowing that the many changes here in the world of becoming will give way to the archetypalization of all relationships. To seek that attentive spiritual sense which will enable you to be impressed and then to interpret correctly and correctly the impressions received. So to see beyond and within all the evanescent changes. So I'm going to just throw a little beyond in there, and it will help later. To see beyond and within, the evanescent changes, to see the spiritual plans and purposes which are at work behind the scenes. This is something that we gradually learn to do, but it takes a lot of training. It is not easy, and the astral body certainly has to be subdued if we're not going to become agitated over these apparently difficult fluctuations. Maybe we can remember that in these times as we lead up to 2025 and during the time that the world will go through great stress, as it always does when there's going to be a major emergence. So the first stages of the plans for the real externalization will be taking place, in all probability, says the Tibetan, in 2025 and beyond. And then the plans for the reappearance of the Christ, which are known only to him and to maybe some of his very closest co-workers. Okay, so we do not want to be disturbed. We do not want disturbance to prevent accurate impression. And this depends on our attitude. We can allow ourselves to get upset if we will, but that will just make the waters more turbulent or muddy the waters, and we will not see the higher world reflected in the lower. I have said that initiation is in reality a great experiment with energy. Not on all planets has this experiment been going on. I do believe it was, according to the Tibetan, attempted on Venus and proved so successful on Venus that it was tried, is being tried on the alter ego of Venus. Well, which is the alter ego? Let's just say a very closely related planet, the Earth. The life of the occult student is consciously lived in the world of energies. I mean, we all unconsciously live in this world, but we study astrology and rheology and the creative hierarchies, you know. We study many different kinds of energies and try consciously to live within them, handling them or responding to them in the correct manner. Those energies have always been present, maybe not always at equal intensity because there are cycles, highs and lows, during which the energies affect different planets in different ways at different times. Those energies have always been present, just like the revelation of that which is always present. Question is, do we receive it? Those energies have always been present for the whole of existence in all the kingdoms of nature is manifested energy. But men are not aware of this. And that's the whole thing. You know, the big battle is not so much in the realm of action, but of consciousness. The big battle for progress is in the realm of consciousness. Then the activity will rightly follow an elevated consciousness. So men are not aware of the presence of these energies. And you know, when you do begin to be a little bit aware of something that you didn't see before, it can be quite amazing to realize that it was always present, but that we were simply blind to that presence. Well, on and on it goes until our consciousness is that of the entire universe in every particular. we become in full consciousness the universe we have always been and the universal logos we have always been, or at least during this universe, although there really is no difference in identity between the infinitude of universal logoi. There's always been an infinitude of universal logoi appearing cyclically. No matter how far back you go, with any kind of concrete measure, no matter how large the number may be, it's always been preceded by an infinitude of cyclically appearing universal logoi. The thing is so big that what we are is so small that we might as well enjoy the perpetual motion of the ride that never began and will never end. So anyway, human beings are not conscious of these energies, for instance, when they succumb to irritation and find themselves voicing that irritation in loud words or angry thoughts, that they are taking astral energy and using it. They don't know that it's astral energy that is, at this point, being unconsciously used by them. And, you know, so many of us, what is it? Irritation is the last fetter or limitation which a master has to overcome. The idea is presented that if he's so powerful that if he gave in to irritation in the direction of any particular student, it might be very bad for that student. The old story goes about Master K.H. that he once became displeased with a student and let that student know his displeasure, and the student committed suicide, had a profound effect upon him. I think maybe when he was Pythagoras, and change the way he would relate to students in the future. You know, I don't know that much about it, but you get the idea that never would that kind of energy, irritation, displeasure be released again in that way because of the possible consequences. It's one of those stories, you know, our lives are marked by these very impressive episodes, many of which we have, well, the great majority of which we have forgotten. Even in a particular life, one might forget important episodes that impressed one. But when you think of the many lives we've had, there have been these episodes, very impressive, and they have shaped our character, and we somehow carry them with us as memories of what action should be taken, not so much of recollection of what happened. But we've been molded by these impressive moments. And when you find yourself just unable to do something because you know it's wrong, it points to an impressive moment. Or when you find that you just have to do something because you know it's right, there's an impressive moment lying in the background of your lives. And it has done what it must to shape you as a being and to stay with you as you continue to evolve. So anyway, this astral energy we're talking about, so many of us from time to time give into it, the use of this energy admits them with ease to the level of astral living, which is not suitable for them. Continual use of the energy brings about what the Master Moria has called habits of residence which imperil the resident. You know, I guess I have read all this before because I seem to anticipate by a few sentences what is going to be said, of course, much better by the Tibetan. But these associations are in my mind from being impressed during earlier readings of the material. Habits of residence which imperil the resident. We are residents within our personality, and that which we are attempting to achieve is jeopardized by certain tendencies to give in to a lack of control in certain fields of our personality. Maybe astral, but, you know, there are mental habits which also imperil the resident. So this is, you know, the idea of imperil comes from Master Mori, at least in his present presentation, and Master DK has taken it up. It is when the aspirant recognizes that he himself is composed of energy units held in coherent expression by a still stronger energy, that of integration, which we are gradually achieving, that he begins consciously to work in a world of forces similarly composed. Excuse me. He then begins to use energy of a certain kind and selectively, and takes one of the initial steps towards becoming a true occultist who always rightly controls the energies with which he is endowed. So control, Saturn, Uranus, these abilities, the first ray, the seventh ray, these are factors which must be strongly developed if we are to become the true occultist, and in our case, the true spiritual occultist. This world of energy in which he lives and moves and has his being is the living, organized vehicle of manifestation of the planetary logos. We live in this great logos. Through it, energies are circulating all the time. You know, we're just confining ourselves to the logos, but vaster possibilities exist. Through it, energies are circulating all the time and are in constant movement, being directed and controlled by the head center of the planetary logos. So all of this circulation of energies is not haphazard. The circulation of energies is not haphazard. That's correct. Not haphazard, but regulated from the head center of the planetary logos. They create great vortices of force or major points of tension throughout his, the planetary logos's, body of manifestation. You know, and one wants to be aware of these so one can know when they're coming and cooperate with them. This would mean being somewhat of a master of the science of cycles and having what is called on the third subplane of the atmic plane, all knowledge. The spiritual hierarchy of our planet is such a vortex. So maybe every chakra, it's a heart center. So maybe every chakra or center is a vortex. Humanity itself is another, and one which is today in a condition of almost violent activity owing to its becoming a focus of divine attention. So when the planetary logos puts his attention on a vortex, the activity of the vortex increases greatly. Oh, sorry. And, you know, sometimes we think, well, it's all of man's doing, all this mess we're in and all this chaos we're passing through, but great cycles involving changes from the Piscean to the Aquarian age, and involving the coming in of the seventh ray and the fading out of the sixth in one of its lower cycles. These big things, you know, the emergence of the soul of the planetary logos through the coming out of the Christ, the elevation of the human kingdom into the kingdom of souls, at least a certain proportion of human beings. All these are very big movements, which, if not all of them originating with the planetary logos, at least are guided by him and by his purpose and plan. Okay, friends, like I said, I don't know how long this program really lasts because I failed to press my little chronometer here. Got to think of so many things, but this is the end of Rays and Initiation Webinar Commentary number 60, and we seem to be on page 550, and maybe we began Well, we did begin. Yeah, we began on 547. So this goes to 550. And we will take up further discussion. You know, I realize just scratching the surface in a way, but at least familiarizing or refamiliarizing ourselves with extremely valuable teaching from the Tibetan, 547 to 550, and today is the 7th of February, 2017. So this will, our beginning will be right here. I've raised an initiations webinar commentary, number 61, from page 550 to whatever, and we'll see when we can do it. You know, if I see the light rays behind me, I kind of blotting out the picture altogether. Interesting lesson. We've been given so much. Astonishing what we've been given. So what can we assimilate? What can we apply? How seriously do we take it? What can we do for humanity? Because we have been given this great teaching, which is devoid of glamour and illusion, the usual illusions anyway, you know. If you don't get rid of illusion until the 9th initiation, and that would probably just be one kind of illusion, then, you know, almost anything we write in any of our languages has got to be subject to the factor of illusion, but certainly it's not subject to the factor of the great heresy of separateness, which is the major illusion we must overcome. Okay, so thank you, and we'll be seeing you again as we press on. Only another, oh my goodness, well, there's some hundreds of pages still left here for us to consider, and if I plug away at it and you plug away at it, listening and grasping what you can and wish to, then there will be benefit all around. Okay, bye-bye.